Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. So today I'm here with Claire Flynn Levy from Accenture Analytics. And what Accenture Analytics do is use technology to track the behaviours of fund managers in order to improve their performance. Am I right in definition? Yeah. And tell us a little bit about your background and how that led to Accenture.
Well, so I was a portfolio manager for many years myself, originally in the long-only world, traditional active management world, as a tech specialist in the late 90s, which was great fun. And then I ran a long-short hedge fund in the early 2000s. And I found it very frustrating not to have an accurate feedback loop on where I was actually adding value and where I wasn't, and what it was that I was actually doing to add or to destroy value. Nobody really asks themselves these questions when things are going well. But as soon as they're not, and you're interested in improvement, you turn to data, or at least I turn to data, to say, please prove to me where I should be focusing my energy going forward. And the fact was there was no technology available at the time that could answer that question for me. So that's really why I started Accenture. It's sort of the same concept that athletes discovered decades ago about having a data-driven feedback loop on your performance.
And what sort of improvement in performance do you expect to get from that data?
Well, you know, humans are brilliant at a lot of things, but the field of behavioral finance has taught us that we are also biased when it comes to making decisions with money. And that's not always a bad thing, but in a lot of cases, it does lead us to do irrational things like hold on to losing positions for too long or to take profits too early. And if you can analyze somebody's past decision data and effectively hold up a mirror to them and say, look, this is you in the mirror, just between us, not trying to embarrass you, but you keep on holding on to your losers for too long or you keep on taking profits too early, how about if we remind you the next time we see you're about to do the same thing again, just give you a little nudge and say, heads up, you might be about to succumb to one of those biases we've shown you before. Still up to you what you do with that information, but help you to make a better decision. And what we find is that people do make a better decision if you can call their attention to it at that moment.
Interesting. Yeah. So it's more about quantitative data rather than anything qualitative. You don't do psychometric tests or anything sort of more psychological.
Well, we don't, but I think that area is very interesting in that it's another data set. You know, so no matter what the psychometric test is, if we gave it to all of our clients and could then connect the dots between the types of personality that get revealed by that test, the types of decision-making skills and biases that we detect in each portfolio manager's behavior, and the outcomes, you know, who's actually creating alpha and who isn't, it creates a proper cause and effect, or at least a link between the psychometric test and the end results that just doesn't exist in the science today, because usually people who are creating psychometric tests don't have access to decision data from investors.
So are you working on that?
We're working on it, yeah. We're not necessarily inventing the tests ourselves, but taking the work that's been done in academia and connecting it to the work that we do.
Very interesting. So what do Accenture do in terms of the data that they do take to analyze behavior?
Well, so we start with, as a bare minimum, your historical trades and holdings. And we're interested in that on a daily basis. So going back as long as you've been trading or investing. And what we do is analyze that for a basic set of skills. So in equity investing, every investment anyone makes involves a picking decision. And then there's an entry timing decision and a decision about how big to go and how fast to get there and adding and trimming decisions once you're in your position. and then a set of decisions on the way out about when and how fast to get out, and maybe even what to switch into. Each one of those is a type of decision, and there's no reason to believe that every person should be good at all of those decisions. So the question is for any new client that comes to us, what am I good at here and what am I not good at, and in what circumstances? So we also use market data to create a context around each position that you're investing in. Context about what the price was doing at the time you made the decision, what was the market doing, what sector is this in, what country is it in, what market cap is it, you know, any piece of data about the thing that you were making a decision on is relevant. And as a starting point, that gives you quite useful insight into how people behave when prices are going against them, or when prices are going their way, or when they're trading very frequently versus less so, or when they're making a lot of small incremental buying decisions instead of just going for it. You know, who's to say which one is right or wrong? There really isn't a right or wrong. But for some people, the urge is to tiptoe into the water, and when actually the more efficient answer would be to cannonball it, you know, or vice versa. So we look at that, and we then, you know, feed back to you, here's how you look, you know, on these different measures. What should we dig into? And thus begins a journey where we start to focus on the things that particular person finds most interesting and relevant.
So on the initial bit where you're picking a stock and you're looking at that part of the decision making, there's a whole host of decision factors as to why you pick a particular stock. Mm-hmm. What are you looking for there? What sort of characteristics are you looking for?
Well, so the question really is, why has the investor picked that stock, right? And everybody has different reasons. And getting those reasons into a structured format where you could do analysis on them is not straightforward. Ideally, we'd be able to read the mind of every person we work with, and of course, that's not possible. So what we do is look for commonalities in the data that are just a characteristic of the position, you know, and that might be about the fundamentals of the company. But we also nudge the individual to ask them, we see you've just bought however many shares of, you know, whatever stock, why did you just do that? And the why part is not as blunt as that, but we will have decided in advance with that person, what are the maximum five questions you want to be asked about why? And it might be about your conviction level, or it might be about your target price, or, you know, any number of different things. But that gives you an opportunity to be very disciplined about capturing that information up front, which is important. And it means that we have data points to go on as to why you originally did what you did, which we can then connect to the outcome later on.
And looking at the whole gamut of the data you collect, what are the typical patterns of what might be areas for improvement?
Well, so people's behavior when things are going against them is typically not the most rational. And we've seen that in the behavioral finance literature. But loss aversion in particular underlies a lot of biased behaviors. I mean, retail investors have been shown in academia to be four times as likely to sell a winner as to sell a loser. And, you know, we can all think of situations where we've done that. It's much easier to take profits, isn't it? And yet, that's not necessarily the right call. You know, often it's really about running your winners and cutting your losers. And not cutting losers is costly, you know. So in that same academic research, they show that it costs 4.4% of ROI per annum, running your losers too long.
And do professional investors tend to do that?
And professional investors do it too. Now, they're less likely in our experience to cut winners too early. They're usually pretty good at running winners, but they do struggle to cut losers. And, you know, having worked with a lot of different firms, you can see how that manifests in committee behavior or, you know, need to talk to this person and this person and this person, there's always some logical reason that they're not cutting that position. And yet when you look at all of these positions in the aggregate, you can see the behavior is very persistent. And what we do is then say, how about we'll start nudging you. Once a week, you'll get a list of positions that you're currently holding that look like they're falling prey to that bias you've shown in the past. And just remember that historically, we've shown you that if you had cut every position that appeared on this list the first time it appeared or the third time or whatever, you know, we back tested to figure out what the right number is, it would have historically saved you 50 basis points per annum or whatever the number is. So just to remind you of the amount of money we're talking about, you know, for a professional fund manager, 50 basis points is massive. Yeah. You know, that's enough to take you straight to the top, you know, decile. Yeah. So yeah, it's worth it to get that right. And that's the healthiest place to find those gains is in loss aversion.
And where else would you be looking to find those gains?
Well, other ones that are the most prevalent, I would say, are around overtrading. Overtrading in the academic literature is connected with overconfidence. So the idea that that whatever I do, it's likely to have a good effect, right? So if I'm going to overtrade, it's because I believe that every time I put on a trade, it's likely to go my way. And yet, why should I believe that? You know, from a portfolio manager's point of view, there are times when overtrading is the result of boredom or of, you know, I used to talk about itchy fingers. Mm. But the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of portfolio managers and even more so retail investors out there who believe that their trading is productive when actually it's the opposite.
Yeah.
And so if we can detect that they're doing it and remind them, you know, not saying you have to stop, just FYI, you know, then it's up to you to decide whether to change your behavior or not.
And do you find there's a bias between male and female traders or investors?
Well, so we have not sadly had much opportunity to analyze female investors.
Yes.
That's a whole nother story in itself. But in the academic literature, it's been shown that men are more susceptible to overconfidence and therefore to overtrading. So
yes,
I would expect to see that play out in our work as well.
Very interesting. And are there any other patterns that are predominant in order to increase performance?
Well, there's definitely some interesting data that we see around how people behave when momentum is very strong. So a lot of professional investors are very good at calling an inflection point. So when a stock price is going down, they catch the bottom just as it turns. And we show them an analysis that reveals that, if it is the case for them. And yet the same people, when they're getting sucked into momentum, when the share price is going like that, they tend to catch the top, you know. And depending on what their investment style and mandate is, they may want to be aware of that and to ask themselves some extra questions before they enter a position that's been going up for the last 2 weeks or last month.
So you're saying they'll catch the bottom, but they're also very good at buying very near the top.
Well, they're bad at buying very near the top. What they're doing is when they're going against the market, they're very good at calling that turn.
Yeah.
But when they're going with the market, they're just hurting. You know, it's hurting behavior that's programmed into us.
Because they're seeing it going up and up and they haven't got into it before.
It's the fear of missing out, you know. Everyone else is in this. There must be something going on here. You know, I don't want to be underweight. I don't want to miss out, whatever. I mean, you can think of lots of different ways of explaining it to yourself. But the fact is, you're at a very fundamental level being pulled towards the herd. And that may or may not be the right thing. Mm-hmm. The answer really is to create an extra set of sort of safety valves, you know, questions that you ask yourself to make sure that the real reason you're buying this is a legitimate one and not just, you know, an emotional one.
Is it easy if you hold up the Looking Glass, or if you tell them that they're doing this, is it easy for them to change their behaviours? Because our habits get so entrenched in us. It might be, you might theoretically know what you should be doing, but it's sometimes quite difficult to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hardest part. And showing somebody some analysis is useful, but it doesn't automatically translate into changed behavior. And that's where a lot of firms struggle, because they have plenty of risk analysts and you know, quantitative researchers and people internally who can do this sort of work. But the problem is those people then sit down with the portfolio manager, and the portfolio manager doesn't necessarily do anything with the information. Now, in some cases, it's because a portfolio manager feels that that person has never sat in my seat and so can't really understand what I'm going through. All of the consultants who do deliver this news at Essentia and work with the portfolio managers are ex-portfolio managers in their own right. So that's an important point, really, for getting their trust and their, you know, getting their mind to open. But then, even if they sit in a consultation and look at the data and you talk about it in great detail and they go away thinking, wow, that was fantastic, I really understand, I'm going to do things differently, that doesn't mean they're going to do things differently, right? I mean, we all aspire to do lots of things that
well,
we never actually do.
Well, you're measuring then if they are doing it differently, and do you find that they are doing it differently?
So typically to start with, no. You know, they go straight back into doing everything the same way that they always have done. And then we come back again and we sit down again and we say, it's interesting, you haven't changed your behavior at all. Why do you think that is? Let's discuss. And then we start sending them, if they want them, nudges that it's just a little message that comes up. Maybe it's once a day, maybe it's once a week, but something that just reminds you, remember how you wanted to change that behavior? Here's your chance. And what we find is that people do change their behavior when you nudge them. But they have to have trusted you in the first place. Yeah. They have to have trusted the data that you've shown to them. The nudge has to be speaking to them in terms that they appreciate. Maybe ask, if it's asking a question, it needs to ask them a question that they care about answering. It needs to come at the right time of day. You know, there's a lot of variables in there, and it is a very personal thing, you know, so it's really the opposite of one size fits all. And so what we've built as a technology company is a platform that can offer that tailored service to individuals using a centralized platform.
And how long does it take for the behavior to change? Because initially there's huge resistance, and then, you know, as you keep chipping away, there's more openness. How long does it actually take for change to filter through and for you to be able to see it in their results?
You know, it all comes down to how engaged they are, you know. So we've seen people whose behavior has changed within 6 months. I don't think we've yet seen anybody's behavior change that meaningfully in less time than that. But that may be just a function of the data and an inability to capture enough data in a shorter period to measure the change. We've seen other people where they change their behavior within a year, and then it lapses back to what they used to do. And then when we call their attention to it, they're like, oh, okay, back on it, we're focused. I mean, this time of year is especially interesting, because people are planning for a new year. They start to think about, okay, my priority for next year is sell discipline, or, you know, not over trading, or whatever whatever it may be. If you can be very clear with yourself about that goal and refocus on it, then your behavior can change back, you know, for the better. And in that particular case, that's what happened. The person, their behavior changed for the better to start with, then it lapsed, then it went back, and now he's performing amazingly well. And the beauty is, it's him that did it, not us. You know, we're the coach that's cheering you on and showing you the data and helping you to be very honest with yourself.
So what sort of increase in performance does someone that really engages with you manage to achieve?
Well, I'd say on average 50 basis points in the first year. But we've seen far more than that in some cases. So you know, we can't necessarily say this person's performance increased so dramatically and that's all down to us.
Yeah.
But what we can do is measure the decisions that are being taken on the back of the nudges that we're sending and the sort of effectiveness of those decisions. And what we see from that is people's decisions are good. It's a question of calling their attention to the decision that needs making at that moment. And that's where we humans struggle. And that's where machines can be most useful. You know, they can be scouring the market and looking at timings and looking at, you know, your own behavioral patterns and then teeing up decisions for you to make. The human is still better at making the decision.
But presumably the market plays a part. And this year we've had a year of very low volatility, so it doesn't make us so emotionally volatile. Whereas, you know, the year before it was much more volatile with Brexit and lots of economic factors going on. Mm-hmm. Would you say that that changes performance, or do you find that your data and your nudges can help someone outperform no matter what the market's doing?
It should be able to help you outperform no matter what the market's doing, because the behavior is very persistent over time. Mm. We have clients who have 10 or 15 years worth of data, and they're interested in seeing whether their behavior has changed, you know, throughout. And when we first started doing it, we thought it was quite possible that it had as well. You know, maybe in a more volatile market, I behave differently, or in a bull market or whatever. The reality is, no. We all have the moves that we do on the dance floor, and it doesn't matter what dance floor we're on. We always kind of like fall into those same moves.
I mean,
some of those moves are brilliant. Some of them are ridiculous. And if you had a mirror in front of you, you might not make that move. And that's really what we're able to show people, that it's not about the market. As much as you think it is, the behavior is, it's more about you.
Talking about it being more about you, how important do you think one's beliefs are in whether we believe it's possible for us as to whether we will outperform with investing or not outperform?
That's a really good question. I think it's extremely important. If you don't believe that there is really an opportunity for you to outperform, you should probably pack it in. You know, I mean, there are plenty of people out there who don't believe it, and that's why index funds are doing as well as they are. But there are also people who do believe that they can. They don't necessarily believe that they were born, you know, skilled in alpha generation. Mm. I mean, that's that idea that you're innately talented towards investing is something that, you know, has been disproven, as is the case with most skill activities. Mm. There might be, you know, in sport, a particular physical build that lends itself to being an excellent player in a given sport, but that doesn't guarantee you anything. Mm. And it doesn't mean that somebody who doesn't have that build can't be even better than you. Mm. And the difference is, are you prepared to engage in this cycle of continuous improvement? And do you really want to be good at this? If you do, and you're prepared to be very intellectually honest with yourself, it is absolutely possible. And we can prove that with data, because a lot of our clients are consistently skilled at what they do. But then there are plenty of people out there that are not comfortable looking in the mirror, not comfortable really trying that hard. And I think the industry historically has made that possible, but that's changed now. So I think we'll see a separation, you know.
Why do you think it's changed now?
Well, I think that, you know, index funds have obviously been around for a long time. But the fact that in recent years, active managers have struggled so much to outperform, it's called people's attention to the fee differential and the sort of, hang on a second, you know, if you're not going to outperform, why should I pay you more? Mm. That's been a rude awakening.
Yeah.
Whereas it was all, the index funds were always there as an alternative. They might not have been as cheap as they are today, but people were making pretty good money as active managers, and there was a belief that active managers were adding value by being active. And the closer the industry, you know, started to look at the details, the more it started to question, hang on a second, are these humans actually adding value or are they not? Now, it's very easy to take blanket statistics and say, no fund manager adds value. I mean, it's just not true. There are plenty of fund managers that consistently add value. It's just not the average U.S. equity fund manager that was in that study. But the I mean, there's a lot of, people who are leaving the industry or who have already left being fund managers who are not convinced that they're the ones who would win, you know? And that's okay. I mean, it's quite a useful conversation to have with oneself because there's plenty of other things you can do with the knowledge that you've gained, you know, in that profession.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the retail investor, based on your experience, are there any tools or tips that you can give them for improving their performance?
So I haven't seen much in the way of tools for retail investors. I mean,
you're not going to launch something yourself.
Well, we would really like to. I think the key is getting the retail brokers to want to offer it to their customers, because in the enterprise world, we're with professional fund management firms, the firm gives us the data, we do the analysis, and so on. In the retail world, you need to get the data from the retail platform, and there are, you know, specific rules around that, that will be in place. So you need the broker to want that to happen, or you need the investor to have access to their data in such a way that they can give it to you. I mean, that said, I think there are things that a retail investor can do either with or without us that don't necessarily require analyzing the data. I mean, that would be ideal, but even just keeping a journal of your, you know, investment thoughts is a discipline that makes a massive difference. Anybody who's serious about investing will have read books by George Soros and, you know, Warren Buffett and whoever else saying keeping an investment journal is very important. And yet, how many people actually do that? Not that many.
I always think it's very valuable for the things that went wrong. Do you think it's good for the things that went wrong and the things that went well and just the mundane that you've got holdings that just keep doing what they do? Do you think you write everything or just the things that went wrong?
Everything. Everything. Because you don't know at the time, you know, whether it's going to go well or badly. And our memories are so warped. You know, we have this tendency to remember things in such a way that they make sense now.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not really why you bought that stock, or that's not really what happened. And it's not that you're being disingenuous. It's just how your brain works. So much better to have a record from day one for every position you've ever looked at. I'm looking at this stock. Here's what I'm thinking. Here's how I'm feeling about it. Whatever you want to capture. Regardless of whether you trade it or not, but you've now got a sort of timestamp of having looked at it at that point.
Yeah.
And then for the things that you do decide to buy, capturing very sort of structured and consistent data about why, when, how much, you know, whatever the things are that you care about. But like, what was the plan for this on day one? That means that you can then later on analyze that data if you want to and look for commonalities. You know, you might find that things that you buy on the back of earnings, you know, where there's been an earnings surprise that wasn't recognized appropriately by the market, or it might be from reading a certain research source, or it could, you know, any combination of factors, really. Those might be your best ideas or your worst, you know, and it's quite useful to know that in an objective way that isn't subject to your recollection, which is, you know, by definition inaccurate.
And how often do you reckon that people should go back and look at those notes on that particular stock when they're reviewing that holding, when they've sold that holding?
Well, I think any time you're considering making a decision, you know, so you might have had I don't know, a good run in a given name and suddenly it's starting to come off and you're getting nervous and you're thinking about selling, go back to that initial plan. Why did I buy this in the first place? What was my target price? How long did I think I would be in it? No, you know, there's no rule saying you have to wait for that long, but at that point, one of the questions we advise people to ask themselves is, how will I know I'm right and how will I know I'm wrong? And that way, you can ask yourself, you know, you can look at what's going on right now and say, okay, am I wrong? No. Has it reached my target price? No. All right. You know, just because it's selling off a little bit doesn't mean that I need to get out. Or maybe my thesis is broken. That's how I knew I was going to, if I was wrong, it was going to be for this reason. I'm wrong.
Such as what would show you that you're wrong?
Well, so one example might be a new management team comes in and you've got great faith in this management team, but what's the measure of whether they're good? Well, I would expect them to have made some announcements about consolidating the business, or maybe I'd expect to see other management change, you know, happen as a you know, subsequent to the new CEO. If I'm not seeing that, I might be wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
Or, you know, it comes down to results.
Yeah.
You know, what did I think the company was capable of doing by when? Is it doing that? No. Is there a good reason for why it's not achieving those goals? You know, there's lots of explanations.
Yeah.
And sometimes there will be a good reason. They've made an acquisition or you know, something happened. But being able to, I mean, this goes for any kind of decision, not even an investment decision. You know, when you embark on something that involves risk, if you can say to yourself, okay, in 3 months' time, I'm going to check in, and here's what I would have expected this risk to have paid off as. Mm. And if it hasn't, here's what I'm going to do. And if it has, here's what I'm going to do. And if you set that out on day one, 3 months later, it's a lot less emotional.
Absolutely.
You know? And you end up making a more rational decision.
Very good advice. Mm-hmm. What other tips based on everything you do here?
Well, I would say being prepared to look in the mirror is something that doesn't come naturally to everyone. But it is hugely beneficial. So, you know, if you really want to be good at investing or anything else for that matter, it's really important to be able to see both your strengths and your weaknesses and address them. And if you think that you're not prepared to do that, probably best not to do the activity would be my advice.
And how do you define looking in the mirror with investing? What are you unraveling, or revealing, I should say?
Well, you know, recognizing that you're not good at everything all the time. You know, it seems so obvious, and yet our instinct is to fight back against anything that doesn't tell us what we want to hear. Mm. That sort of open-mindedness is a really important quality to have in investing and an important quality to have in life in general, particularly as, you know, computers and AI and all the rest start to infiltrate more. The human ability to be resilient and open-minded matters more than it ever did before. And that definitely matters if you want to improve at pretty much anything. So, you know, our best portfolio managers are ones that we would characterize as skilled but humble. You know, it's not the slick back hair, gold watch guy from times gone by. I mean, there are fewer and fewer of those around anyway, but the arrogance is in some ways, you know, a powerful positive factor for fund managers, a sort of ability to carry on going in one direction when everyone else is telling you you're wrong. I mean, that's being a contrarian. But being able to take a step back and look at the truth of the matter and say, okay, I was wrong on that one. Why was I wrong? It's not because I was a bad person. It's not because I'm stupid. You know, just what are the facts? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a lot of what's described in Ray Dalio's new book, which is, you know, all about his principles. But at the end of the day, it's about being prepared to look in the mirror and identify the truth and learn from it.
Yes.
And that's scary, but it is entirely doable.
Yeah. Now, Ray Dalio's book is fantastic. Can you give me the title of it? I can't remember.
It's called The Principles.
Yes, and it is absolutely superb. I was listening to a podcast on it recently, and it's well worth listening to.
Yeah.
Any other books you'd recommend, particularly on the behavioral side?
Well, the one that, you know, if you were going to read one book about all of this, I personally like The Success Equation by Michael Mabuson, which is very much written for investors. I think that, and he talks about sport and he talks about business. He makes draws a lot of parallels, but it really resonated for me as a professional, ex-professional investor. And the other one, you know, there are things like Thinking Fast and Slow and Nudge and all of the rest are excellent reads also if you're into this field. But the other one specifically for investors that I really like is called The Art of Execution. And that's written by a portfolio manager called Lee Freeman Shore, who's based here in London. And he runs a multi-manager portfolio where he's identified patterns in the behavior of the different portfolio managers that he allocates money to. And it resonated for me both as somebody who observes lots of portfolio managers, but also having been one, the behaviors that he observes, both good and bad, are things that were very familiar.
Fascinating. Thank you very much. Claire, it's been tremendous speaking to you. Thank you for imparting your wisdom to us. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.